Next up on This Week in Law, Bruce Boyden and George Contreras join Sarah and me. We're going to talk a lot about the Swiftinator and what her discussions with Apple mean for the streaming music industry in general. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court and Spider-Man. We'll talk about patenting stakes and go way under par discussing live streaming of sports, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 309, recorded June 26th, 2015. Swift juices Apple. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution that can help your law firm and any small business save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/Twill. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/Twill and entering the promo code Twill. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell here with Sarah Pearson, my co-host. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Denise. How are you? Glad to be back.
Wonderful. Oh, it's great to have you back. Oh my gosh, we've got such a great panel and so many wonderful things to discuss this week. I don't know if it's because the Supreme Court is issuing all its opinions this week or if Taylor Swift has just gotten up on her soapbox and decided to impact tech policy all on her own. But we've got a lot to talk about and a great panel to do it with. Let me introduce them to you straight away here. George Contreras from the University of Utah is joining us. Hello, George.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you. George teaches intellectual property law, law and science, and property law at Utah, and we're just thrilled to have you on the show.
Thanks. I look forward to it.
Also joining us from Marquette University Law School is Bruce Boyden. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, Denise. How are you?
Wonderful to meet you. I'm doing well. Thank you. Bruce teaches copyright, internet law, legal history, and civil procedure at Marquette. And we are equally thrilled to have you joining us this week, Bruce.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, so I alluded to Taylor Swift and Apple Music. I think that's where we'll start. We have a number of entertainment-related stories this week. Twitter is a wonderful thing, but I'm so glad when we have people on the show who highlight things on Twitter that I've missed. You obviously miss more than you're able to take in on Twitter. So Bruce, good catch that you found Ryan Kahlo's tweet, which basically sums up the back and forth that we've seen since the last show between Taylor Swift and Apple better than anyone I've seen capture it. He says, it turns out there are actually five modalities of regulation. He's saying to Professor Lessig, law, norms, markets, code, and Taylor Swift. Of course, this is a reference to Professor Lessig's writings about code is law and other things. So that just made my morning, Bruce. Thank you for pointing that out.
My pleasure.
So I kind of, before I saw this put so nicely by Ryan, was thinking, well, I really want to talk about the Taylor Swift Apple back and forth. But, you know, I do try and tie in what we're discussing on the show with actual tech law and policy considerations. And at first I was thinking, well, this isn't really, you know, a legal thing. Nobody is legislating here. Sure, royalties are involved, but really this is a back and forth between private people and an agreement that they've reached. But the way that Ryan has put it definitely shows how those norms are the norms of our society, the laws that become codified, grow out of these kinds of discussions between musicians on the one hand here, Taylor Swift in this case, and organizations that dictate how they're paid, Apple, in this equation. So I think we have all the reason in the world to get into this. Let's explain what's been going on for anyone who hasn't been paying very close attention. Apple is on the verge of unleashing its streaming music service, Apple Music, sort of the renaissance of iTunes is how I think of it anyway. Apple finally getting into a competitive situation with Spotify and other streaming services, RDO and others. They've been doing a lot of publicity and promotion, and it's hooked me. It looks like something I'm definitely going to at least give a try, especially because Apple has decided for the first 3 months, the service is going to be free so that you could kick the tires and decide whether this is something that could replace some other service that you're already using and maybe work better for you. But originally, during that time when Apple is not asking its customers to pay for its new streaming music service, Apple had told artists who will receive royalties from having their music included that they wouldn't be paid for that free trial period. Taylor Swift wrote an open letter to Apple saying how much she disliked that situation, not so much for very successful artists like herself, but she was going to bat, she said, for independent artists who would suffer more from not receiving royalties for that period than others might. And Apple relented. Apple came out publicly and has said, you know what, this was a bad idea and we're going to eat the cost and we are going to pay artists during that period when we are not being paid by users. So this has been kind of a big deal, and I'm tempted to start calling Taylor Swift the Taylornator. So let's get our panel's opinion on Taylor making policy here. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, it was really an amazing turnaround. It was quite surprising to me that Apple announced or the news came out about the free plan and that individual artists wouldn't be compensated for streams. And then within 24 hours of Taylor Swift's open letter, you know, they reverse course. And I guess, you know, it makes you wonder what the overall strategy was on Apple's part. I guess it was just the hope that, the smaller artists would go along and none of the more significant established artists would complain because they'll know that down the road they'll get a big payment out of the service. And Taylor Swift upended that. And it's consistent, I think, with her, her approach to music and copyright and who pays for it all in general. This is a consistent stand she's taken. And I thought your intro remarks were right on point that, there is a background of a legal policy dispute here, the rate making for the statutory rate for Streamcasts. That proceeding is underway now to determine Streamcast rates for the next 5 years. But really, I viewed the most significant thing about this event as basically a norm battle, a battle to set the norms by Taylor Swift and other artists on two levels. One is, do distributors of music such as Apple and Spotify and others, what's their obligation to pay and compensate artists? Is it something that they can expect as a business norm that essentially they can get, it's basically music on spec, so to speak. Or is the assumption that all performances must and downloads must be paid for? And I was surprised actually on that level, Swift's letter and her approach here was very successful from what I've seen on Twitter and on Facebook and other avenues. People who I don't normally associate with being very enthusiastic about copyright enforcement were all like, yeah, Taylor Swift, go after Apple, way to go. I think she's got a broader agenda, which has come out in the past, which she expressed, I think, in the Wall Street Journal, which is that valuable things should be paid for. And it's my opinion that music should not be free, which goes not just to Apple, but to users, to the listeners and to downloaders. A number of artists, Swift included, have been very suspicious and very disenchanted with the idea of ad-supported digital streamcast, the digital public performance right being compensated out of ad-supported services. And I don't quite understand what the concern is. I think it's that they don't think that they think that a bad precedent is being set if consumers can get any streams of their music, their performances, without paying for them, without paying for them out of pocket, that merely watching ads is not enough. And I think they're trying to set that norm. That's why they're so opposed to free ad-supported services. And I don't quite understand it, why that's such a bad thing, given that songwriters have existed off public performance rights, you know, through ad-supported radio and other services, you know, since 1922.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the parts of this narrative that has been lost in the coverage that I've there's been a lot of coverage about this. And there are two points that I haven't really seen coming across, and I think they're important points. And the one is the Pandora point, the fact that what we're seeing here is an artist complaining for not getting paid enough from streaming music. And the Pandora point is, we're paying you. Radio does not. And that has been the case for quite some time. And there is pending legislation that may alter that scenario, the Fair Pay Act, but it is not law yet. And we have no idea if it will be. There's definitely some tension between what terrestrial radio has to do and what streaming services have to do. And the short answer is that terrestrial radio doesn't have to pay as much as streaming services do. So at some point, there's a temptation to jump into the discussion and say, well, you're complaining about something that actually pays you more than radio play. Let's see, what was the other point? I've spaced on it. Let me think of it while George responds to the Pandora point.
Yeah, well, artists have been complaining about the lack of royalties for terrestrial radio for about the last 50 years or so, right? Because you're right, there are lots of movements to change that. I'm not sure that that's really so apt anymore, and that many people, except in their cars, listen to terrestrial radio. But I tend to wonder about this dispute and really whether this is as big a deal as it's made out to be, right? I mean, at the end of the day, nobody is disputing whether distributors have to pay artists for their music. I mean, Apple knows that. Apple wasn't trying to challenge that as a legal matter. They knew they did. This is just a contract dispute, right? Mm-hmm. A negotiation over what the contract is going to be. And Apple's position, you know, was pretty reasonable and actually pretty normal in the content industries. Book publishers. I mean, it's absolutely normal for book publishing contracts to say that you don't get a royalty on review copies that are sent out for free to reviewers, right? Or preprint copies, copies that are given away for free. And that's standard throughout lots of these industries. Promotional copies generally don't bear a royalty. In this case, Apple had a 3-month free promotional demo of its service. It's not getting paid. And, you know, again, I think norm setting, you know, as Bruce mentioned, you know, could go both ways. I think there are norms in the entertainment business around who gets compensated when stuff is given to the consumers for free. And generally.
Did we lose him?
Well, I'll jump in. So, I mean, I agree with all that. One interesting aspect of the Taylor Swift letter was the point where she said, you know, I'm not really doing this so much for me, And I think that's accurate. I don't think that was just a self-serving statement. But for you know, smaller, less established artists who otherwise wouldn't have the negotiating power with a distributor the size of Apple, in order to contest not getting paid for you know, this promotional period. You know, what I found interesting about that is, to the extent that the major recording labels are, you know, losing some of their influence and power, you know, who knows what the future will hold. But one possibility of the way technological development may point here is that, you know, large aggregators of artists such as the major labels may, you know, lose some of their power because, you know, we don't need them anymore to press records. But to the extent that that's happening, we might be heading towards a different dynamic between recording artists and, in this case, distributors such as Apple and other streaming services, where all the power essentially is in the hands of the few large distributors. And I was interested, George mentioned, you know, authors and publishers, book publishers, because there, certainly, you know, pre-76, there was a lot of this dynamic where individual authors essentially had no negotiating ability with publishing houses, at least until they became well-established. As a result, you know, you had situations where, like, for example, Philip K. Dick, you know, an amazing author, dies essentially penniless. I think that's another, you know, aspect behind what's going on here.
Right. And I recalled the other point that was in my head that I thought had been sort of lost. And it goes to the norm making aspect that you brought up before, Bruce. And the goal here seeming to be that the establishment of a norm where artists don't have their music being free and ad supported in any arena. And the thing that's not being brought up in the context of this Apple Taylor Swift conversation is YouTube, which is how many, many people get their music these days. And YouTube is actively building out its music delivery UI and making it, you know, as much as it can, a more pleasant and competitive experience. And that's nothing if not ad supported, but YouTube doesn't seem to be taking similar flack, at least not yet. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't quite understand what's going on with YouTube. So, you know, I read cases, you know, my life as a law professor is I read cases, you know, and so I know what the courts hold. I did not practice music law in practice. I did mostly work for film and television industry clients when I did copyright. So I don't know the background here. My reading of Section 114 of the Copyright Act is that YouTube might be getting away with not paying any digital public performance royalties at all, because I'm not certain it's covered by Section 114, since it distributes them in the form of audiovisual works. And digital public performance rights don't accompany music that is included with an audiovisual work. I don't know that that's what they're relying on. And I don't know that they're not paying digital public performance rights. It's possible there's an out there for YouTube that these other services that are audio only don't have. That could be why there's no complaint about the rates YouTube's paying. It's possible that they're not paying any. I don't know the business, the insider story of the business deals here.
Right. And I think there is, I think you may be onto something there on the legal side, but I also think that there are likely negotiations and agreements that are non-public with labels in any event, as far as music being available through YouTube and compensation for that. And, you know, we don't have access to what the specific terms of those agreements are to be able to have authorized music available on YouTube.
Go
ahead.
Well, let me clarify that. Yeah. So they are clearly on the hook for copying any sound mm-hmm. recordings. I mean, they have, you know, immunity for copies uploaded by users. But if they want to keep those copies on the service, and if they want to send out any copies that they've made on their own, obviously they need licenses for that. Specifically, what I was referring to is they've got a, you know, when they've got user uploaded copies for which they haven't received takedown notices, but they're streaming these out as part of YouTube created playlists. Mm-hmm. Are they paying the digital public performance right to the sound recording copyright owner? And I don't know the answer to that, but it's possible that they're not. I don't know. It's a whole set of we kind of skipped over. We went right into Taylor Swift and the battle over the rape making proceeding and norm setting and all the rest of it. I mean, to get back to my earlier thought about, I'm curious why the performing artists are so adamantly opposed to ad-supported free services. They seem to have a visceral reaction to it. Mm-hmm. That struck me as interesting because, it's essentially the opposite. Well, it's not quite the opposite, but it's different from the situation that songwriters have lived under for decades. They get compensated out of public performance revenue from ad-supported services such as traditional radio broadcasts. And I think this is just an interesting development, an evolution of copyright law that's sort of been spinning out of the decision in 1972 to recognize a separate copyright in sound recordings to begin with. It used to be the case that when people thought of music copyrights prior to 1972, federal copyrights, all you were talking about was the composition, the lyrics and the notes. And Congress has slowly been coming around to recognizing a fully separate copyright in the sound recordings, but it's been slow. When they added sound recordings to the Copyright Act in 72, it was sort of a halfway edition. They said, okay, you can have a separate copyright in the sound recording of a work, of a musical composition that might be owned by somebody else. So there'll be two copyrights in this recording, but you're only going to get part of the rights for a copyright owner. You're not going to get a public performance right. So there's not going to be two public performance rights that broadcasters and bars and others have to pay. And then second, you don't get a derivative works copyright. So all you can prevent other people from doing is making literal copies of the sounds that are captured on the recording. And it's been that way ever since. And as George mentioned before he dropped off, people have been, the songwriters have been complaining about the rates they get from ASCAP and BMI and the radio stations and the record labels and the performing artists have been complaining about the lack of a public performance right ever since 1972. And they've been trying to add it back in. And this idea that, we don't get paid enough out of free ad-supported services strikes me as kind of not really accepting the idea of a public performance right that's distinct from revenues from sales of downloads, that the artists are kind of viewing that as essentially one pot. And to the extent people aren't downloading and they're streaming, that's basically just, a substitute for the revenue that we'd otherwise be getting from reproductions, from downloads, from copies being made.
Yeah. This is George. I'm back. And you know, what you say is exactly right, of course. I mean, looking back to the debate in Congress when the 76 Act and the performance right were being discussed, and the reason or one of the principal reasons that terrestrial radio won out and didn't have to pay a performance royalty to performers was that they made the argument that, terrestrial radio is basically just a big free advertisement for performers for record.
Oh, no.
No. All right. We'll resurrect George when we can. And hopefully he can pick up his train of thought. Let's get back to the 1972 law and whether this new case out of Florida, district court case that is held in favor of SiriusXM and against the Turtles, impacts the discussion at all. This is not the only one of these cases pending, correct? And other ones have gone the other way?
That's right. So there have been three cases so far that have resulted in decisions from district courts. So there's mm-hmm. one in California, one in New York, and now this one just out of Florida, like this week. Two of them, the first two, the California and the New York courts, I think both of them on summary judgment, or it might have been a motion to dismiss, but both of those courts said that under the law of the relevant state, California and New York, pre-72 sound recordings, so prior to the recognition of a federal copyright in sound recordings, those are not preempted. Any state law rights to those are not preempted by the Copyright Act, obviously. And less obviously, those rights that the sound recording manufacturers have under state law include not just rights to prevent copies being made, a right of reproduction, but also an exclusive right of public performance. That's part of, in New York's case, the common law of New York. And in California case, they said it was due to a statute that California had passed. So that means that pre-72 sound recording copyright owners can sue, at least if those decisions stand, for infringement of the public performance right, not only against streamcasters, but what they said was it's essentially a traditional public performance right. So it applied in both of those cases to Sirius, the satellite broadcaster, and also it would apply to radio stations or, you know, bars and restaurants, anybody else who's playing a sound recording. So I think that's it. You know, that's a humongous deal for a number of reasons. And so both of those decisions have been appealed to the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuit. So there's further proceedings there. With this one out of Florida, the judge basically decided, you know what, there's not a history of common law recognition of any sort of common law rights in Florida for sound recording owners or makers. And so I'm not going to extend it to public performance. So now we have, it's not a circuit split, it's a district court split.
But this
would upend a lot. Because if there's a state law right to prevent public performances of pre-72 sound recordings, it's not covered by the compulsory license in Section 114 for streamcasters. It's not covered by, it applies to terrestrial broadcasters as well as everybody else. So it's not limited just to digital public performances. It's across the board. Oh, and it's also not within Section 512, the DMCA notice and takedown provisions, which provide immunity to ISPs for material uploaded by users. It doesn't exactly deal with public performances, but to the extent there's enforceable rights there, it falls outside those immunity provisions. So this is a big deal that courts are recognizing, you know, the full panoply of rights in sound recordings prior to 72 that goes beyond what the post-72 federal copyright provides.
Right. So play that out for us. Say the Florida, if this results in a circuit split, and ultimately we get that circuit split, gets the Supreme Court involved, and we get a definitive statement that goes the way that the Florida court has gone here. What does that mean?
Well, that's a good question. So the issue just occurred to me, which I hadn't really thought through here. So both of those are being appealed, but it's a matter of state law, whether or not there's a common law right or a state statutory law right to protect pre-72 sound recordings. So I'm not even sure how it would get to the Supreme Court.
The gay marriage case did, right? That's a matter of state law as well.
Well, but the rights being asserted there are 14th Amendment due process and equal protection rights.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not sure there's a constitutional argument you could make that recognition of public performance rights in pre-72 sound recordings violates some sort of, I don't know what right.
Or Article 1, Section 8.
Commerce? Yeah. You mean the copyright clause?
Yeah.
Dormant copyright clause?
Yeah, who knows? I think it's weak.
All right, yeah, we'll have to see what happens with it, but it's kind of exploding my head trying to figure out what is going to happen with pre-1972 sound recordings based on how the courts are, the disparate treatment that we're getting of this in the courts. George, do you have a thought? Can you forecast the future for us?
No. And I feel that if I try to, Taylor Swift is going to jam my signal again, so I'd better stay quiet.
All right. Sarah, a question for you about getting back to Apple and its service and compensating artists for streaming and how we, you know, whether an ad-supported system is what artists want or need. You can bite on any of that if you want, or you can bite on, you told me on Twitter that the Apple streaming music system probably wouldn't replace Spotify for you because for now it's a paid service. There is no freemium aspect of Apple Music yet. Bob Lefsetz thinks that Apple has to go to freemium, has to go the Spotify model where part of it's free and ad-supported and part of it is not. Do you think that, let's assume that it does, that Bob's right and that it does adopt the Spotify model. Do you think that that is good or bad for the artists?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to the question of what's good for the artists, because in a lot of ways that depends on what kind of artists you're talking about. I mean, you're talking about the Taylor Swifts of the world. It's probably a good thing because it sounds like Apple's going to pay a slightly higher rate than Spotify. But if you're talking about the artists we've never heard of, I don't know. In general, I think Bruce touched on a really good point, which is this idea of the resistance to access to music for free under ad-supported models and how there's a visceral reaction there. And I think in some ways that's a rational resistance, because there is something to, once you get accustomed to getting something for free, like with me, I use the Spotify free account and I just don't see any reason. I'm not enough of a music person to spend money on Apple's service or Spotify's premium service. It's just, you know, once you get used to the convenience of it and it's free, you really have to add a lot of value to then switch to a paid model. So I guess I can kind of understand what their resistance is to that model, especially if they think it means less money. One other thing I was just thinking as we were going through all of this is music copyright law has always been, I've never really worked in it. So it's always just so confusing to me because there's so many little differences and different rights. And then when you get into the pre-1972 sound recordings, that's a whole other thing. And it's fascinating to me because it seems like most of those differences are not built on any sort of rational basis. It's just kind of the way that the law has evolved, which makes it even harder, I think, to kind of wrap your head around. And
yes.
So when you get into these arguments about, well, shouldn't we make all of it consistent? I mean, there's a very logical argument that yes, we should, because the reason for the difference in the first place was never really very, you know, rational, or there wasn't any reason for it. It just is the way that it evolved. So I don't know.
Right.
I think that's kind of interesting.
It's like a geologic formation. It's been formed by accretions over the years. But things like the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act are meant to do what you're discussing, Sarah, try and bring some consistency to the way that royalties are paid. George, was that you jumping in? Do you have any thoughts on whether consistency is possible or a good thing?
Oh, no, I was simply going to say it's, you know, it's not a random process like geological formation. It's the mm-hmm. very well thought out process of industry lobbying and backroom deals that yeah. made the Copyright Act for Music what it is, you know, and in a pretty predictable way if you look at it stage by stage. But still, yeah, results in chaos if you look at it in hindsight.
Yes. So do you think any of the pending legislation is at least a partial solution to the chaos? Bruce, do you have an answer to that question?
Yeah, my answer is probably not. I'm not sure how much consistency is a virtue in this area, particularly since, you know, there's an existing model or business model for traditional broadcasters under which, you know, they only worry about one set of public performance rights. And then layering on a second set of public performance rights on top of that, I think would be, you know, very disruptive for them, certainly. I don't know. I guess I view this more accidental than George does. You know, a bit of a historical accident. I think, you know, the reason why, you know, sound recordings were added in 72 in this sort of partial way is because it just kind of developed as a business matter or as a matter of historical development that we had, as a practical matter, two separate copyright owners asserting rights in recorded, or, you know, two separate entities asserting rights in recorded music. And you don't typically have that for really any other art form. I certainly can't think of one off the top of my head where you have this level of, you know, business interest behind separate copyrights that are both, you know, viable and none of them are assigned to anybody else in any other form. So really music is kind of on its own here. And I think it makes sense not to pile two complete set of rights. You know, the record label people I meet from time to time are going to hate me for this, but I don't think it makes sense for two sets of rights to be added on top of each other across the board just to make them consistent, you know, in both areas. I think the argument that wins out in the streaming case that's different from terrestrial broadcast is in the streaming case, you know, where you can shape a playlist or a download service to reflect your preferences, it really can substitute for a music collection to a much broader degree than just, you know, selecting from among, like, you know, three or four radio stations in a certain format in your area. And so I think that's the difference in the number of stations. You know, you combine or the number of services. You combine those two things together, and you really can go without a music collection just listening to Pandora or Spotify or Apple Music or whatever it is.
Right, and I guess another point that we haven't brought up yet that's worth mentioning about all this is that Taylor Swift is not available on Spotify, but has decided that Apple Music addresses some of those problems, as Sarah pointed out, because they have agreed to pay more for two artists and labels for and songwriters and everyone else in the food chain, I'm guessing is the case, for their, you know, the more of what they receive for their service will go to all of the creative side of the equation. So that says something. And I also thought it was interesting. We have another piece in our discussion points, which folks can access at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/309, talking about Lars Ulrich. Also, you know, and for those maybe not able to remember back to 2000 and what went on with Napster, Lars Ulrich and Metallica were instrumental in the debate, the legal debate about Napster and what Napster was doing to artists. Very vocal about Napster being a terrible evil to creative artists. But Lars is on board with Apple Music, and Metallica will be there. So, Sarah, do you think, you know, either of those points is notable?
About Metallica.
And Sarah Swift, or Sarah Swift, Sarah Taylor Swift. that's your alter ego. Being on board with one service as opposed to another.
I mean, I think it comes down to Apple's commitment, at least at this point, to pay more to artists. I was just thinking as we were talking, I wonder, you know, does that just mean lower profit margins for Apple, or are they where, you know, because I don't know. Or is the money from the subscriptions, is that what's going to make up for the extra to be able to pay the artist more? I just wonder if it's going to be a sustainable model or not. And I just don't know enough about it to know. But I think that that'll be interesting to watch and see how it develops in that regard.
Yeah, definitely. Because they're lower priced in some ways, and by offering the family plan that involves six people, if you take full advantage of it. And competitively priced in others. Any thoughts on this, Bruce?
Yeah, well, I think the difference for Taylor Swift, I don't know about Lars Ulrich, but the difference there is after this free rollout, as I understand it, Apple Music is going to become a subscription service. Maybe I'm wrong about that too. But
yep. No, it is.
Okay, yeah. So you know, that's the difference. I mean, it's this reaction against the freemium ad-supported services that seems to make the difference. And I don't know how much the rate that they're paying for the free service, you know, even after they knuckled under, even after Apple knuckled under, the rate they're going to be paying to artists for streams during this service, during this rollout period, I'm not sure how different that is from Spotify. I read it's going to be 0.2 cents per stream, which Apple characterized as you know, essentially what Spotify pays. Afterwards, when it goes to subscription only, I think the royalties per stream change and are probably higher, but I don't know the figures on that.
Right. Okay, let's go around and see if we can get our final thoughts on the state of streaming music. George, anything you want to add to put a period at the end of this sentence?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and it's fun to end with Ulrich as well, because...
No! We do remember Ulrich and Napster, and I'd love to hear what George thinks about that. Bruce, why don't you give us your final thoughts, and we'll see if we can get George back.
Yeah, Lars is listening to us too, apparently. My final thoughts. You know, it's as with any period of transition, you know, the whole idea of how music is consumed and paid for is in extreme flux right now, and that's very disruptive. And so I think what's going on here is everybody's trying to figure that out. Not just how is it going to be paid for, but you know, how is it even going to be consumed or produced in the future? How the producer is going to be paid? So you know, I think that's what's behind all the anxiety. Activity here.
Right. Sarah?
I guess I kind of go back to something, another thing Bruce mentioned earlier about maybe we're going to move to a world where the platforms have, you know, all of the leverage and the artists don't have any. That in some ways that can sound kind of like a negative thing, but I think it's just a different, I guess I kind of think that that is probably going to happen. There are just going to be, I think there are going to be a lot more people making art, and there already are, and making music, and we're going to be a lot more just small-time artists, independent artists, and not as many Taylor Swifts out there in the world. I guess I imagine that's the long-term future. I don't know how long that's going to take, but I think that that's probably the way that things are going to go eventually.
Right. And I definitely see the future evolving on two tracks, the paid services and the free services. And I don't think either one is going to go away. I think the free services are probably going to grow more from where they are now. And, you know, I'm not sure what that's going to do economically for artists either. I think that the notion of small artists wanting to make a name for themselves and willing to do it for free, in order to get out there and have a career of any kind, will continue to make the free services viable. And I'm just not, you know, like you, Sarah, I'm not quite sure how economically it's all going to work. And we're just going to have to buckle our seatbelt and hold on, because it's certainly going to be bumpy along the way. You know, unless we're able to come in and normalize and impose consistency, which, you know, I don't think anybody on the panel today really thinks that that's likely to happen. Let's move on to, we're going to stay in the entertainment arena for a bit. I want to talk about gaming in a moment, because Bruce, you've written some really interesting things and pay attention to the unique issues involving copyright and video games. But before we do that, I want to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. FreshBooks is an incredible tool that I use in my own practice to keep track of time and make sure I get paid in full and promptly, and it does an amazing job at what it does. Many, many lawyers spend way too much time pushing papers around rather than practicing law, and goodness knows, as a sole practitioner, that is a devil that I am constantly running from, trying to make my law practice as streamlined and efficient and as much of a well-oiled machine as possible. And thank goodness for FreshBooks, because it makes the accounting side of my business really wonderfully seamless and easy, to the point where I barely have to think about it, and that is just how I like it. I've got to track my billable hours. I've got to track my expenses. I've got to manage client invoices and get them out every month. That's how we keep the lights on around here. And FreshBooks makes my life easier that way, and it can do so for you as well. It's a super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of lawyers the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. It lets you create and send super slick invoices online in minutes, and tracking your time has never been easier. I love that there's a mobile app for FreshBooks that allows you to track your billable time wherever you may be. If you've got some downtime at some other activity as a busy parent and lawyer, I constantly have to walk that line, and sometimes I'm working on things in remote locations far from my office where I am now. So using the mobile app makes that much easier and even possible. It also helps you organize receipts while you're running around to the various busy parts of your life, your client meeting, your courthouse, the soccer field, wherever your life takes you. If you do have questions, the award-winning FreshBooks support rock stars are waiting. There's a real live person on the other end of the phone when you call and need help. So getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days with no obligation. Go to freshbooks.com/twill and don't forget to enter Twill in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, Bruce, let's talk about games for a moment. You've done a lot of writing and thinking about video games as part of your career. And I don't know that there's anything that has popped up in the last week or so that I want to focus in on this topic, except for one thing. I did go see the movie Inside Out yesterday, speaking of running around and doing things with The Offspring. And excellent movie, highly recommend it. Noticed before the film, though, that there was a little Pixar ad for their app that goes along. It's a companion with the film that is, not too surprisingly, very similar to other apps that have been around forever. Things like Bubble Bobble, things like Bejeweled. It is very reminiscent of those things. So how is it that Pixar and others are able to create apps that are so close to other apps and or games and not have much copyright problem?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting issue. So, a lot of the focus of, the intersection of internet law and copyright has to do with the way, technology has changed and therefore has has destabilized how traditional copyright applies to new situations. The situation with respect to games is the exact reverse. There's actually an old rule from the early 20th century that's just been passed down by courts as sort of common law that games are not copyrightable without much explanation for it. It's in the Nimmer Treatise, and there's some speculation about why it's, you know, why this is a rule. And my own conclusion, you know, thinking about this as applies to board games and also video games, is that what's going on is that, you know, games, unlike a lot of other works with copyrightable material, they have, you know, at least two aspects to them. One is the content of the, you know, this, what you might call the surface content of the game, the way it appears, you know, whether it's a board game, you know, the board itself, the shapes of the pieces, or if it's a video game, you know, what the little figures look like and the maze or map that they walk through or whatever it is, the textures, that's all copyrightable as sort of, you know, visual art or sculptures or what have you. But the underlying, you know, game aspect, right? The rules of the game are not, and that's what the old rule applied to. In courts, at least in the early days of looking at arcade games, you know, they tried to fit arcade games into a box where they could analyze what's copyrightable about them, and they stuck them in the audiovisual works box analogized them to movies and cartoons and other audiovisual works, where essentially, you know, the user, after hitting play, just kind of sits there and watches, and all the communicative content is coming from, you know, the maker of the audiovisual work. Games are substantially different than that and becoming more different. So, I mean, what... part of what is being communicated is the surface textures and all that, and that's coming from the game developer. But the what else is in the game is a system, a set of rules that define a system for essentially having fun, for playing the game, for, you know, defining your own experiences. So I've argued that that's uncopyrightable under the same principles that systems are excluded in Section 102B of the Copyright Act. So essentially, the game developer can get a copyright over, you know, the plot, the dialogue, the surface textures, images, whatever, sprites, but not the actual rules of the game. So the example you just showed is a good example of where I would draw a distinction, although I'll admit it's a controversial distinction and, you know, it's kind of up in the air whether the courts will buy this. But and the distinction is that essentially reskins, as long as you're using a different, you know, you're not infringing the software code by borrowing, you know, by taking code. If you write your own code that implements the same rules of another game and you make it look, you know, completely different by putting new textures on top, so it's now inside out as opposed to, you know, bejeweled, that you haven't infringed.
Yeah, I mean, it leads to a very vibrant world of games that are available. It sort of stands in stark contrast to other forms of media out there, which, you know, have such strongly protected and enforced copyright interests. How do you think this is playing out in the video game industry?
Well, it's still up in the air. So, I mean, one of the resources that you link to, the article from the German Institute, I've forgotten the name, the author of that piece actually went out and surveyed a bunch of readers of Gama Sutra to pose the question to them whether they thought it was infringing to have, whether reskins were infringing, basically. And, you know, their intuitions were no, that they're not. So merely taking the rules of the game is not infringing. And, you know, I think courts in general, judges, when deciding these issues, you know, they're driven as much by their intuitions as anything else. And it's too early to say whether or not they're going to draw that distinction too. I mean, there's one case from District of New Jersey that involved Twitter. you know, the thing where the shapes fall down. I now have mental block.
Tetris.
Involved Tetris. But it wasn't, you know, it was hard to say it was a reskin because, you know, how else do you draw the blocks in Tetris, you know, while obeying the rules of Tetris? So it wasn't really a reskin in the sense that we're talking about. So I don't know. There's this. there's this trend in copyright law that cuts against it, which I think is a disturbing trend. So this is part of what I'm trying to push back against. But the trend is, mm-hmm. how do we recognize what's copyrightable expression? Well, was there any creativity in it? The problem is, if that's all you're looking for is some element of creativity, that's overbroad, right? I mean, you know, inventions require creativity. You know, lots of things require creativity that are not copyrightable. Sports, for example. Courts are pretty much agreed that sports, the actual, you know, sports games themselves are uncopyrightable. But there's, you know, there's all sorts of creativity during a sports game. So why aren't those copyrightable? I think it's because you need more than just creativity. You need creativity plus the communication by the author of some sort of informational or aesthetic message to the user. And so the actual play of the game is not the communication of any sort of message. You know, how the game plays out, that's actually content, to the extent there's content there that's being supplied by the user, not by the author. And so that's why I draw the line there.
All right, George, I think you're back with us. We're crossing our fingers that you can stay on with us. We've been talking about video games and the sort of unique role they play in the world of copyright, and how there seems to be a lot more freedom to borrow the look of, to reskin, as Bruce has been saying, and go forward with something that seems a lot like other games that are already on the market. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about both that universe and how it, what it means, if anything, to the rest of the media universe, which seems to approach copyright much more differently. Maybe we don't have him.
Yes, I am. Was that addressed to
me? Oh, there you are. Yes.
Okay, sorry. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay, thanks. I switched to a different microphone system, so hopefully that'll help. You know, one thing that is interesting to think about in the whole games question is, you know, whether we really need copyright at all in this context, right? I mean, because one thing that we haven't talked about, but we will in a little bit on the show, I think, is patents. Games are patentable. Board games have been patentable forever. You know, there's a famous patent on the game Monopoly, which you can look up, and there are thousands of other games, board games, that have been patented, and video games are patented as well. And those patents are pretty strong, right? They offer a fair amount of protection on the method of play, the rules, the systems, the things that you can't really cover with copyright that really would get you purely to the external appearance. And I'm actually curious what Bruce, who's thought a lot more about games than I have, thinks about that aspect of it, whether with or without copyright, game developers have enough protection through the patent system.
I think they have some. So I think the combination of patents in game devices, in software code, methods of, you know, like a game engine. So you combine patents in those things. I'm not so crazy about patents in, like, the rules of a game, which I know there have been, or solutions to puzzles. But even the patents, you know, over the other areas, plus copyright in the appearance and, you know, any commutative content of the game, I think that gives developers, game developers, sufficient protection. I don't know that they really need to prevent all other reskins of their game coming out. I know that the game developers themselves, at least some of them, think they do, because particularly the app developers, and you know, somebody releases an app for the iPhone, and then some other company, maybe a larger company, comes out with something that plays exactly the same, but it's a complete reskin. And there have been lawsuits over that have not gone all the way to a judgment. But I think the combination of those two things gives them sufficient protection to protect their investment for the most part.
All right. Sarah, any thoughts on video games before we move on?
I mean, the only thing I guess I was thinking about was, this is kind of a question for Bruce, is How different is this situation with games than with other types of software programs? Because it seems like so much of the logic would apply to so many types of software we use, where the value is not really in the actual content. It's in the user input, and it's not just like a passive listening or watching or reading experience. It's interactive. And that doesn't seem like it's just limited to games. And I wondered if that same concept, like, is it really unique to games, or does that same concept kind of translate to other types of software-based programs and things?
I think it does. I think it's uncontroversial with other sorts of applications that are not games, because you don't think of them as being like, you know, movies in any respect. But for example, you know, a word processing program, if a competing developer of a word processing program has not duplicated the look of the program, has not duplicated any of the software code, either literally or non-literally, has not duplicated, you know, anything, the menu tree, whatever, although that's, you know, there would be defenses to that, but has not duplicated anything from the other word processing program other than the idea that, you know, you can create documents and, you know, type documents and save them and change your fonts and, you know, all the rest of the things you can do with documents. I don't think anybody would say, well, you know, the first person who came along and wrote a word processing program like that can use copyright to shut down all other word processing program developers in the future. And so it seems to me that, you know, games are just sort of an aspect of that.
So the difference with games is that there's a slightly more narrative aspect. So it feels a little bit more like a movie or a story.
I think the intuition's pulled towards looking for the copyrightable expression in the same way you would look at it, you know, a static play of an audiovisual work.
Interesting.
All right, I'm going to give us our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show if you are listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit and need to demonstrate that you actually listen to or watch the show. We put these in like little Easter eggs for you to find and jot down and be able to show, yes, indeed, I know the secret codes. So this one is going to be Twitter for sport, going back to Twitter versus Tetris. I know people who play Twitter for sport. I aspire to someday, but I don't think I'm clever by half enough to do it. But that's going to be our first passphrase for the show. And as long as we're talking about sport and games, let's move on to our next topic, which involves cameras everywhere and either on our person or maybe ultimately in our person, and what that means for things like sports and entertainment events. You know, golf, it tries to skew itself to a younger audience, tries to have the fact that it has young players on tour that are, you know, getting victories and garnering excitement, kindle interest in what has been traditionally a sport that attracts an older audience. Is sort of comically known for being boring to watch. So it's interesting to see that the youngest accredited journalist on the PGA Tour, her name is Stephanie Way, and she writes a blog called Way Under Par. And she's using the tools that are so readily available to everyone to be able to make her blog entertaining and build an audience. So she recently had her press credential revoked because she took some video of Jordan Spieth, the winner of the U.S. Open, at a practice round. And I believe she streamed it on Periscope. And this is not the first time she has posted videos before to Instagram and gone back and forth with the PGA on whether she's authorized to do that. Now the PGA Tour, you know, when she did this Periscope thing, said, nope, sorry, you're no longer authorized to be an accredited journalist and, you know, get the access that those folks have to cover the tour. So on the one hand, I think this is really sad. And on the other, I think it's really short-sighted of the PGA to decide that their interest in controlling every bit of video that happens at a tournament venue trumps the interest of reporters to use the tools that are available to them. So, Bruce, I think you put this one in our rundown. Tell us what you think the ramifications of this are.
Well, it's a really interesting issue. So I think, just to start off, the legal rights of the, the PGA Tour or the golf course owners are crystal clear. They can absolutely say, that you're allowed onto our property, we'll impose certain conditions on you. And if you violate those conditions, you're not allowed on our property anymore. So there's no real dispute about that. But as you mentioned, the business policy is something I think the major sports leagues, all of them, are trying to figure out. And it's unclear to me what the exactly what the right answer is here, because the increasing conflict I think is coming up here is it's the same for it's the same in other areas of the law generally, not just sports broadcast but privacy or other areas, which is increasingly people are carrying devices that either audio only or audiovisually record everything around them. And they now have the capabilities through services like Periscope to retransmit that stuff, worldwide. That conflicts with the way an awful lot of money is made from things like sports entertainment, which is essentially control of certain gates, right? Control of the access to the content. In this case, non-copyrightable content, the actual, as I mentioned, the actual play of the golf game is not copyrightable. But they control the access, and they allow the broadcasters to come in, and the broadcasters pay millions of dollars for that. And so, if they lose control of that access, they're losing control of their revenue. In general, I think what Way was doing, and what fans in the baseball stadiums and the football stadiums do, is not yet conflicting really directly, I don't think, with that revenue stream, until it becomes so good or so pervasive. Or is aggregated in some way that it actually does become a substitute for the broadcast, the professional broadcast. I don't have advice for PGA or anybody else about how they should approach this. As a policy matter, I think the conflict, is coming down the road where, the fan videos, may become of a quality where people can just watch those instead of watching, broadcast over the air or pay-per-view or whatever.
Right. And we talked about this issue a good deal during the recent big fight when Periscope was used to stream people's HBO subscriptions to the fight. And how that shades the way that fights are packaged and distributed. I do think it's interesting here that we had a journalist, but the fans, are not under the same. Well, I think fans are under some restrictions, or at least the fine print on the back of their ticket would put them under some restrictions of what they can do. If they choose to attend an event. Are you suggesting, Bruce, that those limitations may not be enforceable because the game of golf is not copyrighted?
Oh, no. I don't know that they're enforceable as a matter of copyright law. So, the back of – I've got a Milwaukee Bucks ticket right here in my office. And the back of it says in very small print, the holder agrees not to transmit, distribute, or sell and aid or aid in transmitting, distributing, or selling any in media and any media now or hereafter existing, any description, account, picture, video, or audio or form of exploitation. If I'm recording the game, I own the copyright in that recording.
Right.
But as a matter of contract, I've agreed not to make the recording or transmit it. So I think they could come after people as a matter of contract law.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they would get injunctions on the basis of breach of contract, but they might. So I think there's an enforceable right there. It's just not a copyright.
Right. So Periscope is a tool that makes it easier for a live broadcast to compete with something like a fight, which, as we talked about when we talked about that on the show in some detail, it's the moment by moment coverage there that is so important. Here with Stephanie Wei, she had captured some practice dialogue on the practice tee that, you know, might not have been part of other coverage. It might have been of great interest to Jordan Spieth's fans. So that didn't necessarily need to be live, but it did need to be, as you point out, Bruce, something that was watchable, something that, you know, if it's really going to impact the PGA's ability to monetize its video, it's going to have to be, you know, of a quality that at least people will tune into and not have their eyes bleed. And the tools for that are getting much better too. I don't know if folks have played around with Lisa Bettany's V app for iOS, but as she did with Camera Plus, she kind of looked at the shortcomings of the built-in app on the phone and did what she could to fix or make better the experience for the photographer, videographer. V works really well. It's still, I think, and it's a very basic tool there. You know, it doesn't do things that Final Cut does or even iMovie. But for being able to edit video on the fly and post something that's watchable, it's, I think, pretty groundbreaking. So, you know, for somebody like Stephanie Wei to be able to use an app like that and post something that's edited and, you know, a bit post-produced is a pretty revolutionary thing, too. George, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, I mean, I have very little sympathy for Stephanie Wei. You know, she could use that great post-production processing, you know, to make cat videos or something that she's perfectly legally entitled to do. But, you know, I agree with Bruce. This is pretty well-settled law. I mean, there's nothing, you know, nothing controversial about the PGA's legal position. There have been cases about this going back a century, right? I mean, back to the famous INS versus AP case where the Telegraph, you know, telegraphing news items from the West Coast, from the East Coast to the West Coast to get ahead of the morning papers in the West Coast, you know, was, you know, there was no copyright in the news, the Supreme Court held, but yeah, this was an unfair business practice and could be shut down. There's a whole line of cases involving the NBA and Motorola back when people would go to NBA games and use their pagers to broadcast scores of NBA games while they were going on in violation of their attendance licenses. You know, so there's really nothing new going on here except better technology, right? It's actually much better. I'd much rather watch a video on Periscope than look at some guy's pager feed of, you know, raw scores from a basketball game. Got to be pretty fanatical to want to do that. So it really is just a matter, I think, of the franchises deciding how they want to enable, you know, sort of freelancer and fan broadcasting of these. And, you know, maybe people like Stephanie have to pay something, right? Maybe, you know, mm-hmm. you revenue share or you sign up with a PGA program or something. But, you know, PGA's got to make money too. They produce the content and, you know, having free riders provide the content to the public in this way, you know, isn't necessarily good for the industry or for, you know, for the longevity of the content that they're producing.
Right. And I wonder if she'll continue covering the tour just as an attendee as opposed to a credentialed journalist. It'll be interesting to see if she carries on. Sarah, any thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I have a different take than George. By, you know, the definition of where I work, I err on the side of sharing and openness. So as a legal matter, I absolutely agree they have every right to restrict this, but I think it's short-sighted business practice. In this case, this is not the situation where it's a replacement for watching, you know, watching anything that, that PGA itself is broadcasting, it's only, I think it, to me, it seems like it could only benefit them to have this sort of publicity and generating buzz. It generates more interest ultimately in what they do broadcast. So to me, it seems like a short-sighted business move. I think there are interesting questions about, you know, when we get to the world that you are kind of talking about, Denise, where people who take these kind of live videos on their, of matches and things, on their phones, and it actually is a replacement for the, you know, the licensed broadcast, that is an interesting question about disruption. And I imagine we're going to see, maybe business models being, completely destroyed or changing, but I think that's a different issue than what's going on here in this instance. It seems to me like, I don't know, my reaction was, this just seems kind of like a silly thing for the PGA, but it's a business decision and they didn't ask me.
They should though. Yeah. George and Bruce, if you, I always love to, so much of what we talk about on the show, I think would make a great sort of head splitting law school exam. So some law school exam fodder for you would be to take this Stephanie Wei example and add in her use of the V app and the fact that V automatically accesses your iTunes library to put a music track onto the video that you're creating. Now, if you're doing that for your own personal use, that might not ever trigger anybody's copyright inquiry. But if you were putting it on a blog like Stephanie or otherwise distributing it for commercial use, then I think it could raise some eyebrows. And there you go. So just another little copyright twist for this for your students. Let's torture them a bit.
Before we watching this program.
Huh?
I hope none of them are watching this program.
Yes, I hope not. We'll copy protect it from them if we have to. I want to get into those patent stories that George mentioned a moment ago. But before we do, let's thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, because nothing is more important than a good night's sleep, right? I mean, it's how we're all here able to so sprightly chat about these complicated issues is because we rely on that recharging and regenerating at night. But mattress buying has always been kind of a terrible thing. It's a bit like the accretions in the music regulation world. Buying a mattress has always sort of proceeded along the lines of you go to a showroom and you try and lay down on one and figure out if it's going to be good for you when you're actually sleeping on it. But fortunately, that is changing. And you can now buy your mattresses from Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, for a fraction of the cost that you're going to pay in one of those showrooms. It's revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly on to you, the consumer. The Casper mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress, and it's at a fair price. There are two technologies, latex and memory foam, coming together here for better nights and better days. It's a comfortable mattress that has just the right sink and just the right bounce. A Casper mattress provides long-lasting comfort and support. And I'm actually going to try these things out because the pricing, first of all, is just wonderful for twin-sized mattresses. They're only $500. So say you have some bunk beds you need to fill in. That would be a great way to try out Casper and see what you think about that. Test it out on your kids. Why not? And then if you want to test it out on yourself too, that's the whole point of the Casper mattress, is you do get to try it out. You buy it easily online. It's completely risk-free. And trying out is part of their business model. You get to try sleeping on your mattress. There's free delivery, painless returns within a 100-day period. So you don't have to lie down in the showroom and try and guess what it's going to be like in your bedroom or your child's bedroom. You or they can sleep on the mattress for up to 100 days. And if you don't like it, you can ship it back, and it's very easy to do. Did you know that statistically lying on a bed in a showroom has no correlation whatsoever to whether it's the right bed for you? So you really need to lie on it in your bedroom, see if you're getting that good night's sleep. And if so, you're going to wind up paying a lot less money for a Casper mattress, which, by the way, is made in the United States of America right here at home. Get a Casper mattress, $500 for a twin or $950 for a king size mattress. Compare that to what you can find in the industry and you will find that it is an absolutely outstanding price. And you can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/twill and entering the promo code TWILL, T-W-I-L. That's casper.com/twill, promo code TWILL. Thank you so much, Casper, for your support of our backs and of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk about some patents. All right, a few very interesting things in our patent lineup for today. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Supreme Court has been busy announcing some very important decisions this week. And one of them that you might have seen, or maybe not, maybe we can enlighten you, involves Spider-Man and the patent on the, you know, sort of iconic child's toy that you wear on your wrist and it shoots out a little web, the web shooter toy. There was an agreement concerning this toy that involved payment to the patent owner as long as, not just as long as the patent still survived, but past the expiration of that patent. And that was the issue at stake in this case. Were those payments after the patent had expired enforceable? And the Supreme Court, relying on a 1960s era case, found that they were not. When the patent is gone, so is your ability to collect royalties from the patent. So the original inventor of the web shooter, I'm afraid, is has had his opportunity to earn royalties off the invention, and now he doesn't anymore. This was, I think, something that maybe people don't realize about patent law, is that the Supreme Court wasn't making new law here. It was actually just hearkening back to an older decision in the 60s that has been on the books ever since. It might strike people as surprising, though, that people can't contract around the expiration of a patent. So what do you think about this, George?
Yeah, so this was a really interesting case, heavily watched by the patent community. I was party to one of the amicus briefs that was on the other side of this decision, so I'm a little bit biased. But, you know, Justice Kagan got to write the opinion, full of little Spider-Man references and jokes. It's actually, you know, pretty funny to read. Definitely not the opinion for the ages that Justice Kennedy just released today in the same-sex marriage case. But, you know, a fun read anyway. And her point is basically, you know, stare decisis. We have this old rule from the 60s, and we don't see a really good reason to overturn it. And then that's pretty much what the reasoning was. But, you know, it's a little bit more subtle than all of this. There have been a number of circuit courts and most commentators who have said this rule is just outdated. The old case, the Brulat case from the 60s, was about a guy who invented a hop picking machine, or hop sorting machine, you know, the things that you make beer with. And his deal for buyers of this machine was very simple and seemed very fair. Everyone who buys the machine has to pay me royalties for 17 years, right? That's how long patents used to last. So if you bought the machine in year one of the patent, you'd pay for 17 years. If you bought the machine in year 16 of the patent, you'd still pay for 17 years, right? So everybody paid the same. Supreme Court said, no, you know, that won't work. Because after the patent expires, you can't charge royalties anymore. The thing, the invention, has to be in the public domain. Fair enough. But over the years, people developed different methods of charging for patents, including, you know, methods that would bring the royalty streams out past the expiration of the patent for, you know, just for simple financing purposes, right? I can't afford to say we're in year, you know, patents last 20 years today. Say we're in year 15 of the patent. You're going to charge me, you know, for 5 years a very high rate. Well, maybe I'd rather pay a low rate for 20 years than a high rate for 5 years, because we have to stop paying at the end of that 20th year of the patent term. And Judge Easterbrook, the famous judge in the Seventh Circuit in a case involving Dolby Laboratories, you know, said, listen, this rule doesn't make sense in today's world anymore. Limits the ability of parties to contract. It should be overturned, but our hands are tied. We can't do it. We're just a Seventh.
Oh, that was a really long run that we got out of George, and he was making some really good points. So we're just going to have to hope he can pick up where he left off in a moment here. Bruce, have you been paying attention to this, and were you involved on either side of the case?
No, George is the patent expert on this call, right. But I'll just add my two cents, which are much less informed than George's. But, you know, I thought it was a really interesting application of stare decisis. You know, it indicates how cautious the court sometimes is in approaching IP issues. And, you know, Justice Kagan's reasoning was essentially, you know, she gets all the economic criticism of the old Brulat rule, which is that, you know, many years of low payments or 1 year of high payments, it's economically the same, right? As long as people can do time value, they can calculate the present value of a future series of payments, they can just collapse that into one big lump sum. It doesn't make a lot of sense from that aspect. But she's like, you know what, we're not going to mess with it anyway, because you can't show it's really causing harm. People can structure their deals differently if they're aware of the rule, and Congress can change it. You put those three things together, and we're not going to take the precipitous step of changing a rule in case there's, you know, that disrupts settled expectations in a way that actually would cause a lot of harm.
Right. And the impact of this, of affirming the vitality of the court's earlier decision, is that patents truly enter the public domain after the expiration of their term, which is very short in compared to the copyright term. Sarah, do you have thoughts about the distinction between how patent law works that way and how copyright works?
Well, I thought of the same thing, actually, when I was hearing about this case. I thought, I wish that copyright had something analogous, although copyrights feel like they never expire. But there are certainly things that we know are in the public domain that people sometimes still try to get license, you know, get royalties for, although technically we have copy fraud. But I don't know that we have anything this, you know, like this strong of a rule. So I thought it was kind of interesting to think about. But I haven't read the opinion, I have to admit. I did like the Spider-Man references in Kagan's opinion sounded like fun, though.
Yes, here are a couple of them for other folks who haven't read the opinion. In this world with great power, there must also come great responsibility, writes Justice Kagan, quoting from the Spider-Man comic. And also, patents endow their holders with certain superpowers, but only for a limited time. So she clearly had some fun with this one. Something else that we've had fun looking at in preparing for the show today is this NPR episode that George tweeted earlier in the week, episode 399 of Planet Money, which focuses on the topic of whether you can patent a steak. There's much discussion of that on the show, but I just wanted to get our panel's take on that interesting issue and on the patentability of food. George, are you back?
Yeah, I am.
Yes.
Right, so believe it or not, you can invent a new cut of meat, and we're not talking about genetically engineered cows, right? The way of cutting a steak, you know, can be patented as a method, as can different machineries and apparatus for making different cuts of meat. So popcorn chicken, is a great example. You know, popcorn chicken was patented. The machine for cutting up chicken parts into little pieces that you would deep fry were patented for a long time. And there is a guy who's a serial entrepreneur in terms of steak cuts, who gets lots of patents on different ways to cut a steak, believe it or not. And I have not tried any of his unique cuts because they're licensed to fancy restaurants in New York that sell steaks that apparently are very tender. But they are method patents, you know, not on the composition of the meat itself. That's probably what we'd call a product of nature. But but on how you cut it. So be careful out there.
Yes, you could be infringing on Tony Matta's patent, which presumably is still within its 20-year period of validity. Bruce, any thoughts on this?
It's interesting. I don't think there's anything controversial about the steak patent. Particularly once you view it as, it's essentially an industrial process, right? How do you cut up a steak and then sell the meat cuts you get out of it? It's an industrial process of producing meat. So the really interesting issue to me is, you know, not why is this patentable, but why do people, think it might not be? And I think the intuition there is one that, the Federal Circuit, which everybody likes to knock, has really cautioned strongly against is, it's very tempting to think once something's been explained to you, any idiot could have thought of that. But if no idiots actually did think of that prior to the inventor, that's an indication that they actually invented something. You know, it took actual, skill and inventiveness to figure out you could get this particular cut of meat out of the cow, and it's something that people actually want to buy.
Wonderful. And the other delightful thing that I did not know in looking over this story about Tony Matta, meat inventor, is that Steakums is actually an invented and patented product. So I guess we'll go ahead and make Steakums our second passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you are listening for MCLE credit, hopefully you will either have a gourmet tender cut of patented steak to enjoy, or at least some Steakums while you take in the show. Let's move on to our tips and resources of the week. Our tip of the week actually is just a single tip, and it involves Ars Technica and the fact that Ars was reporting on a new VR system, the newest version of Steam VR, by Valve Software. And its writer went out and interviewed some folks about it, got some commentary, what's your take? Do you like it? And one of their interviewees compared it to an IMAX experience, said it's like saying I have an IMAX theater in my house. It's so much better than we can get away without a cumbersome setup. So just kind of standard fare for Ars Technica. But what wasn't standard about this is IMAX didn't appreciate being mentioned in the story. Wrote to Ars and, unlike the PGA, asserted some rights that it probably doesn't actually have. Said that it did not appreciate being mentioned in the story in the context of describing the virtual reality product, thought it was misleading to readers, didn't believe it was possible for a virtual reality system to replicate the experience of an IMAX theater, and so that the comparison should be removed. Of course, what we're talking about here is journalism and reporting, and IMAX actually has no ability to control its trademark in the way that it asserted here. And once IMAX figured that out, to its credit, it did absolutely the right thing and wrote to Ars In fact, it was the IMAX chief marketing officer, Eileen Campbell, who issued an IMAX-sized mea culpa, she called it, and recognized that although they're passionate about their brand, that they were being overzealous in this instant in trying to protect it. So our tip of the week is think hard if you're trying to control your trademark in a journalistic setting. You might just wind up having to issue an IMAX-sized apology. And if you do make a mistake, the apology that was issued here, I think, nicely did the job. Our resources of the week are twofold. Number one is something from Bruce from a couple of years ago. And if you've ever wondered what a sans affaire is, it's something in copyright law doctrine. And he's written a great post about this that will bring you up to speed. Essentially what it is, it's sort of esoteric, but it's an exception to copyright law that involves similarities and incidental details necessary to the environment or setting of an action. They're not material that is copyrightable. So Bruce, why did you feel the need to explicate on sans affaire?
For that very reason, it's I think it's two reasons. One is it's not that well understood, and not all that commonly invoked, I think, even where it can be. But then second, also, you know, it's I thought it was it's an interesting area where you know, the underlying cohering principles behind some aspects of copyright law, I think, is getting lost over time. So that's one thing I addressed in the post, is why the doctrine was invented originally, speculating a bit, and then why it's become a bit of a strange fit for copyright law now. And I think, you know, my take on it is that originally it excluded incidental details, although courts always say necessary to carrying out the scene. I don't know that they're necessary they need to be necessary to the scene in order to qualify as sans affaire in the cases where that's actually been applied. But I think it was more like a materiality threshold. And one thing I think has happened in copyright over time is the materiality threshold for what, you know, when you do copy, how much copying do you have to do to be on the hook for infringement before you even get to the fair use analysis? I think that's been dropping to the point where courts mostly nowadays say, you know, if it's merely recognizable that it came from this other work, you know, that's infringing.
All right, and we have a second resource for you to check out if you're not already following and reading the tweets of SCOTUS blog, S-C-O-T-U-S blog. This is the definitive resource covering the Supreme Court, and this week is a particularly good time to be reading it, not only for the breaking news and wonderful insights about the substantive opinions coming out from the Supreme Court. But on Twitter, what happens to SCOTUS blog, and this is not the first year that it has happened. In fact, they just tweeted a few days ago, it's a tradition. Trolls bless us with insights they actually intend to send to the justices, and we helpfully respond. Let it begin. So what winds up happening is people think that SCOTUS blog is the blog of the Supreme Court. They have their own trademark confusion issue there. And so people who are upset with the Supreme Court's decisions tweet to SCOTUS blog and vent. And SCOTUS blog responds. So what winds up happening is you get these wonderful posts on their blog, and the Twitter feed posts you to, you know, the breaking news from the court, the wonderful analysis of the decisions. And you also get these incredibly fun, snarky responses to the people who are challenging them, thinking that they are the Supreme Court. So let me see if I can find a good one here. Yes, here's one. Somebody tweeted to SCOTUS blog, "You're rewriting law, not interpreting. You failed us again." And SCOTUS blog responds, "We make the law and you will like it." So they go on in that vein over and over again. So I don't think that there's ever been quite the combination of hard news and fun that the SCOTUS blog Twitter feed manages to be at this time every year. So don't miss it. Go and enjoy for yourself. and become edified while you're there. We hope that you have enjoyed and become edified during our show today. We have certainly enjoyed bringing it to you. And I can't thank our panelists enough. George, thank you so much for hanging in there. We're so glad that you have not just thrown up your hands and thought that the technology just isn't there yet because Skype wasn't doing a great job of keeping you with us today. But we've been so glad to have the bits of you that we've been able to get. Thank you so much for joining us.
Nope. Thank you. And, you know, we'll get this internet thing perfected someday.
I know. I hope so. Right. It's been a while. You would think that we would have it down, but like the show itself, it's a work in progress. So we're really thrilled that you've been able to join us. Tell us, is there anything going on at Utah that you'd like to let people know about?
Well, we've got a lot going on, and probably the thing that is causing the problems is we're moving buildings in a couple of weeks. And so I think the construction project outside might have had something to do with this. But on the, you know, the issue of the patents on the stakes and Monopoly games and so forth, I'll be presenting a paper at the IP Scholars Conference this summer on silly patents that collects together all of these crazy, silly patents that have been issued and tries to bring some sense to them and figure out why they actually have been issued by the patent office after all that. So something, you know, something that is coloring my summer and making it fun.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's right up our alley here on This Week in Law. So we look forward to that. Bruce Boyden from Marquette University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Denise. It was a pleasure.
Anything you want to let us know about before we go ahead and head out the door today?
Well, I'll just point to one thing that's it's not specific to Marquette, but one thing that's linked to on your the list of resources there, which is the Seventh Circuit decision from a case coming out of Madison, Wisconsin, involving the mayor of Madison, a photograph of him, in which the ultimate decision that the use on a T-shirt was fair use is not a barn burner, but the reasoning, the Seventh Circuit might have just gotten rid of the transformativeness test for fair use in the Seventh Circuit. And said, you know, market harm determines all. So that's the most significant copyright development I can think of.
Oh, yeah, that is a big development. We might have to go into that in more detail on a future show. And this is right up Sarah's alley, too.
It is, yeah. I haven't read the opinion. I'll have to read it.
Sarah, thanks so much for being here with us this week.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Yes. And then we lost you last week. We're going to lose both of us next week because the show is taking a break on July 3rd, but we'll be back after that. And if you'd like to watch this episode again or other past episodes of This Week in Law on July 3rd, I'm not sure if we're going to run a rerun or what exactly the studio does when we're not here live. I'm sure that they make good use of the time. But if you're ever looking for our back episodes of the show, they're available at twit.tv/twill. You can enjoy our new Twit website when you head on over there and look for those back issues. There's lots of information about how you can enjoy the show on whatever technology you prefer to use. And we're just glad that you can join us whenever and wherever it works for you. If you enjoy watching live, we certainly enjoy having you do that. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So stop on by the twit.tv site at that time if you want to play along with us live. What else should you do? You should get in touch with us between the shows. You should email Sarah. She is sarahp@twit.tv. I am denise@twit.tv to let us know your thoughts about cuts of steak that you prefer, patented or otherwise, about guests we should have on the show, about your reaction to Supreme Court or other decisions, although you really should be tweeting at SCOTUS blog if you want to vent about the Supreme Court decisions to get them to give you a wonderful snarky response. And so do get in touch with us by email. You can also reach us on Twitter, of course, as well. That's a great way to make sure that we're keeping up with the things that you are keeping up with. Also, Facebook and Google Plus are great ways to have a lengthier discussion with us. So we're just so glad that you've been able to join us. We think these topics are fascinating and have a huge impact on all of our lives. So they're complicated and sometimes difficult to understand and ever-changing, and we're so blessed to have the wonderful people who really understand these issues join us each week. So thanks again, George and Bruce, and we will see you next time on This Week in Law.